with real majors fare better in the job market and rack up higher selfish returns. It is tempting to infer the major premium is all about skills. Signaling may explain why fine arts majors earn more than high school grads, but human capital explains why engineers earn more than dance majors. On inspection, however, the skill acquisition story is overrated. About three-quarters of STEM majors and half of engineers end up in jobs that don't use their specialized training. STEM degrees impress a wide swath of employers, opening doors to careers in not only technology but finance and business. What does this mean for social returns? With cautious signaling, excellent and good students in high-earning majors like electrical engineering still do well. With reasonable signaling, however, the most qualified students studying the most lucrative majors remain burdens to society. The same goes for students at highly selective but affordable colleges and students who love school. Social investments in their education are relatively rewarding but absolutely wasteful. Gender and social returns. Working women usually get a higher selfish return to education than working men. Socially speaking, however, two weighty offsetting factors arise. First, women are less likely to apply whatever job skills they learn in school because fewer women seek jobs. Second, women, regardless of education, commit virtually no crime. Male college graduates are more criminally inclined than female high school dropouts. The social value of curbing female criminality is therefore low. How do the sexes' social returns compare when you snap the pieces together? In high school, investing in women usually pays better, with the key exception of male poor students. This isn't because female poor students are less morally deserving. Quite the opposite. Investing in women is socially unprofitable because women avoid wrongdoing of their own accord. Beyond high school, educational investments in men perform better across the board, though better only means not as wasteful. Doubts. Every section in this chapter builds on interdisciplinary study of the evidence. When the evidence is mixed or weak, however, I state my best guess and proceed. Fellow academics may recoil, but candor trumps caution. If we researchers withhold our best guesses from voters and policymakers must act on their own best guesses, corrupted as they are by popular pieties about the glories of education. But candor is more than the open statement of conclusions. It is also the open admission of doubts. My social return numbers have all the shortcomings of my selfish return numbers, plus several bonus shortcomings. Think of them not as red flags, but as yellow flags, lingering concerns meriting further investigation. Signaling's share. My best guess says signaling accounts for 80% of education's return. I even anoint this the reasonable position. Still, I am open to revision. A few outstanding studies could talk me down to as little as 60% or up to as much as 90%. While the cautious assumption puts a high floor on signaling's share, future work on the sheepskin effect might show it's smaller than it looks. Like any competent forecaster, I do not plan to downgrade signaling, but signaling is so understudied that energetic researchers could quickly double the totality of our knowledge, warranting major rethinking. Participation and ability bias. Social returns hinge on workforce participation, the fraction of graduates who want to work. Educated workers have relatively high participation rates. Some of this stems from ability bias, but how much? Social returns require a straight answer. Unfortunately, straight answers are scarce. Papers asking if the average college grad didn't go to college, how much money would they make are plentiful. Papers asking if the average college grad didn't go to college, what are the odds they'd be in the workforce are nearly non-existent. To bridge this research gap, I set ability bias for participation equal to ability bias for earnings. But a few good papers could show this shortcut is way off. Crime, signaling, and sheepskin effects. The social benefits of schooling weak male students hinge on crime control. My crime numbers start with the all-inclusive cost of crime. Next, they incorporate the distribution of criminal behavior by education, age, and gender. They finish with corrections for ability bias and signaling. While there's nothing I'd do differently, I cannot banish two key doubts. First, careful tallies of the full social cost of crime are scarce. The most comprehensive study covers 1997, when violent crime was about 50% higher than today. Second, crime researchers rarely test for sheepskin effects, so I set sheepskin effects for crime proportional to sheepskin effects for earnings. However, preliminary research suggests the sheepskin effect accounts for all of education's effect on crime. Since cautious signaling treats sheepskin effects as socially worthless, the social benefits my calculations attribute to crime control may be a mirage, making the case against education more monolithic than ever. The educational Drake equation. In Carl Sagan's awestruck words, each galaxy holds billions upon billions of stars. Yet out of the galaxy's countless solar systems, we see but one with life, our own. How can the galaxy fall so desolately short of its potential? Astronomer Frank Drake publicized an elegant equation to clarify the matter. It's called the Drake equation. To simplify, the equation says the mind-boggling requirements for life must offset the mind-boggling opportunities for life. Humanity has the technology to speak to other worlds only because our solar system has a planet able to support life, because life, in fact, arose on this planet, because life evolved into intelligent life, because intelligent life developed the technology of interstellar communication, and because we've yet to destroy ourselves. We'll never speak to an alien civilization unless another solar system satisfies each and every one of these conditions. No wonder the cosmos looks so lonely. In the right frame of mind, education statistics, too, inspire Saganian awe. Look at the lives of high school dropouts, their poverty, their joblessness, their attraction to crime. Compare that to the lives of college graduates with engineering degrees, their affluence, their devotion to their careers, their law-abiding ways. The distance between their lives is astronomical. Imagine the utopia our society would be after transforming every high school dropout into an engineer. Former Harvard president Derek Bach once quipped, "If you think education is expensive, try ignorance." With gains this massive, why fret about cost? Because education's powers of social transformation are galactically overrated. The observed gap between, say, dropouts and engineers is only one term in what could be called the educational Drake equation. For workers, education's social benefit equals the observed dropout engineer gap times the probability of successfully completing the education, times the fraction of the gap not due to pre-existing ability differences, times the fraction of the gap not due to signaling. Suppose the average engineer contributes on balance three times as much to society as the average dropout, but each of the other terms in the educational Drake equation equals 50%. Then education's true effect is the plus 200% observed gap times the 50% completion rate times the 50% not due to ability bias times the 50% not due to signaling. Grand total, a mere plus 25%. Why does my approach deliver unfashionably wretched social returns? Despite the gory details, it boils down to the educational Drake equation. I start with the same observed gaps as other education researchers, but my competitors, usually tacitly, occasionally explicitly, set every other term in the educational Drake equation to 100%. Everyone who starts school finishes. None of the gap is due to ability bias. None of the gap is due to signaling, and everyone works. This is like rounding all the terms in the original Drake equation up to 100%, then announcing that our galaxy contains billions of advanced civilizations. Yes, the well-educated are model citizens. skilled, employed, and law-abiding, but education is not a path to a model society. Indeed, plugging sensible numbers into the educational Drake equation shows the path to a model society starts with a U-turn. Deep education cuts won't transform us, but we can work wonders with the billions upon billions of dollars we save. Chapter 7. The White Elephant in the Room. We need lots less education. White elephant. A property requiring much care and expense and yielding little profit, Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. Elephant in the room. An obvious major problem or issue that people avoid discussing or acknowledging, Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Every government on earth supports education. They support it rhetorically with high praise and financially with tax dollars. The ideal of free and compulsory education, schooling kids free of charge whether they like it or not, spans the globe. Democracies and dictatorships fund different kinds of education, but spend at comparable levels. Industrial policy, picking winning industries to protect and subsidize, is usually contentious, yet industrial policy for education is wildly popular the world over. In a major international survey, clear majorities in every country favor bigger education budgets. To the best of my knowledge, there is no country on earth where most people clamor for educational austerity. American opinion is typical. In the General Social Survey, 74% favor more education funding, 21% favor the status quo, and only 5% favor cuts. Education enjoys bipartisan allegiance. Liberals say spend more on health care and education, not spend more on health care instead of education. Conservatives say spend more on defense and education, not spend more on defense instead of education. Avowed opponents of big government make an exception for education. 60% of strong Republicans hew to the conventional pro-spending wisdom, and only 12% are contrarian enough to claim we overspend. Even my fellow education critics normally argue against spending more, not for spending less. Take Alison Wolfe, Baroness of Dulwich, and author of Does Education Matter? So it would be bizarre to see our education systems as just a collection of huge white elephants, but then no one is seriously advocating closing down all publicly funded education, or even cutting 25% off its budget. What inspires this pan-ideological affection? Pro-education industrial policy is so popular, advocates have little need to share their reasons. When pressed, layman's justifications are emotionally powerful but logically pitiful. We need to invest in people. Reply, we usually rely on the free market to provide crucial investments. We can do the same for education. Nothing is more important than education. Reply, food's more important and we rely on the free market for that. Government has to make sure even the poorest children receive a good education. Reply, means-tested vouchers can cheaply handle this problem. There's no need for government to run schools or subsidize tuition for kids who aren't poor. Layman's arguments almost never confront the question, at what point would education spending be excessive? We've done enough for education is as heretical as we've done enough for paralyzed veterans. Since politicians compete for layman's favor, they parrot these populist clichés. Recall that both George Bushes wished to be known as the education president. Who could oppose investment in our children, our people, our nation, and our future? The Onion, the best parody site ever, once ran an article titled, U.S. Government to Discontinue Long-Term, Low-Yield Investment in Nation's Youth. In it, Secretary of Education Rod Page takes a calmly analytical approach that would cost any politician their job. Testing is exactly the sort of research the government should do before making spending decisions, Page said. How else will we know which individuals are sound investments and which are likely to waste our time and money? The article amuses by being oblivious to the very existence of populist sentiments to which successful politicians piously pander. The best pro-education arguments. What's wrong with them? In all fairness, views should be judged by the best arguments in their favor, and popular arguments are rarely the best. Education researchers craft a far sturdier case for educational industrial policy than laymen or politicians. Despite countless variants, their arguments fit into three big intellectual boxes: irrationality, credit constraints, and positive externalities. Irrationality and credit stories tacitly equate selfish and social returns, then argue free markets leave selfishly profitable, socially valuable educational investments unexploited. Externalities stories explicitly distinguish selfish and social returns, then argue free markets fail to exploit socially valuable educational systems because they aren't selfishly profitable. Irrationality. In irrationality stories, the free market fails to convince students to make selfishly profitable educational investments. Maybe students underrate education's payoffs. Maybe they're too myopic to care about payoffs far in the future. Maybe they're too young to grasp what an investment is. Whatever the reason, irrational students, left to their own devices, shortchange themselves and us by finishing school prematurely. Government support for education helps confused students spot the golden opportunities by making education's benefits too massive to miss. Credit constraints. In these stories, the free market fails to give students the opportunity to make selfishly profitable educational investments. Suppose the normal market rate of interest is 4%. Inferring students will stay in school as long as the return to education exceeds 4% is dogma. In the real world, plenty of students can't afford living expenses, much less tuition, and their credit rating is too poor to borrow the difference. For minors, this is undeniable. Who wants to extend a $50,000 line of credit to a 14-year-old to pay for high school? The lender could know the return to education exceeds 4%, yet still reject the loan for lack of collateral. Left to their own devices, credit-constrained students shortchange themselves, and us, by finishing school prematurely. Government support for education hands strapped students the seed capital to invest in themselves. Externalities. The last best argument for education subsidies says the free market fails to give students the incentive to make socially valuable educational investments. Rational students, with good credit, hungrily exploit selfishly profitable educational opportunities. Trouble arises when their education benefits bystanders, people with no earthly reason to reward them for their help. Unless students are saints, they'll repay bystanders in gratitude by ignoring their interests. Before responding, tough luck for them, remember, we're all somebody's bystanders. Left to their own devices, selfish students shortchange us, but not themselves, by finishing school prematurely. Government support for education entices these students to prolong their socially valuable stay. Irrationality, credit constraints, positive externalities, all three stories are plausible. In a vacuum, each bolsters the case for pro-education industrial policy. There's just one small problem. We're not in a vacuum. An intellectually serious case for industrial policy must account for offsetting forces. Student irrationality cuts two ways. Students who underestimate education's return could easily overestimate their probability of graduation. Students too myopic to care about payoffs in the far future might pursue long-shot degrees to impress their friends or avoid disappointing their parents. The same goes for externalities. In technical terms, signaling implies negative externalities. When students stay in school to impress employers, they hurt bystanders in the labor market who look worse by comparison. Honest defenders of pro-education policies must pool all factors and look at the grand total. In a free market, evaluating the case for some pro-education policies would be straightforward. Estimate education's social return, then see if it exceeds the market interest rate. If it doesn't, doing nothing for education is better than doing something. Otherwise, doing something for education may be better than doing nothing. Why only may? Because government might overshoot. Instead of delicately fostering education until its social return reaches the market rate, government might spend money like a drunken sailor, driving social returns below the market rate. Since no government leaves education to the free market, there is no straightforward way to evaluate the case for the very existence of pro-education policies. Sure, we can estimate education's social return, then see if it exceeds the market interest rate. Given our position, however, this comparison tells only whether government support for education is currently too high, too low, or just right. If, despite massive industrial policy, education's social return continues to exceed the market rate, government still isn't doing enough. If education's social return is less than the market rate, government has gone too far. Last chapter, we methodically tabulated education's benefits and costs. We didn't just tabulate financial effects for students, we tabulated comprehensive effects for society. Result? Education's social return ranges from mildly below market to dramatically below market. Given a modest role for signaling, government overinvests in high school and severely overinvests beyond high school. Given a plausible role for signaling, government severely overinvests in high school and beyond. Either way, government investment in weaker students is especially wasteful, male poor students in high school excepted. Education researchers' arguments for pro-education policies could be valid as far as they go. My own calculations incorporate multiple positive externalities. What low and negative social returns show is that standard pro-education arguments are incomplete. They fail to face the educational Drake equation in all its dismal splendor. Counting everything that counts, industrial policy for education has clearly gone too far. The United States, and probably the rest of the world, is overeducated. Schoolcraft as soulcraft? Some of the most prominent and heartfelt pro-education arguments don't talk about selfish or social returns. Instead, they praise education for instilling admirable values and uplifting the human personality. Education is good for the soul. How can you put a price on that? Economists may scoff, unless your budget is infinite, you have to put a price on everything. But most people, including me, still find schoolcraft as soulcraft a compelling ideal. The ideal is so compelling, in fact, that it warrants a full chapter of its own. If you wish to see it addressed before reading policy recommendations, skip ahead to chapter 9. In any case, if you think schoolcraft as soulcraft is the decisive objection to the proposed education reforms of this chapter and the next, please remember that I do face up to this challenge in the end. How big is your elephant? A classic bumper sticker muses, it will be a great day when our schools get all the money they need and the Air Force has to hold a bake sale to buy a bomber. By most measures, this great day arrived in the United States long ago. The Air Force may not hold bake sales, but total education spending far surpasses total military spending. For the 2010-2011 school year, education was 7.5% of the American economy versus 4.7% for defense. Spending came to over $1.1 trillion on education and a bit over $700 billion on defense. Schools overtook the military back in 1972 and sharply widened their lead after the Cold War. From a conventional point of view, this is great news. Even ardent hawks rejoice we're not sacrificing our children's future to protect their present. Who could oppose ample funding for education? Anyone who takes signaling seriously. $1.1 trillion a year is a royal sum. 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 in longhand. That's nearly $3,600 for every person in America. Not every student, mind you, but every person. Chanting investment doesn't make it so. If half is wasteful signaling, we're wasting over $500,000,000,000 a year, and that's only budgetary cost. A full damage report would include tens of billions of emotionally taxing, socially fruitless classroom hours. One notable difference between defense and education is that all defense spending is government spending, but education spending is partly private. If government spent zero on education, education spending wouldn't disappear, and neither would wasteful signaling. Yet without government support, modern education would be unrecognizable. Like a rich uncle, government helps us waste. Whenever we can't or won't waste our own money on schooling, federal, state, and local governments are standing by to waste taxpayers' money on our behalf. How much do U.S. governments really spend on education? A tough question. We can't blithely equate public schools with government spending and private schools with individual spending. Some public schools receive hefty private funding. Some private schools receive hefty government funding. Neither can we blithely sum federal, state, and local spending because higher-level governments often turn their education budgets into grants for lower-level governments. That risks double or triple counting. If the feds give California $10 billion for education and California hands every penny to local schools, total government education spending is not $30 billion, but $10 billion. The best path to a solid measure begins with the U.S. Census. The Census estimates state and local governments' direct education spending, including all spending on K-12, higher education, plus assistance and subsidies to individuals, private elementary and secondary schools, and private colleges and universities, as well as miscellaneous education expenditures. The 2010-2011 figure is $861 billion. This counts all state and local spending funded by federal grants, but not direct federal education spending or assistance to individuals. Direct federal education spending is hard to pin down, but probably small enough to ignore. Federal assistance to individuals, in contrast, exceeds $100 billion. Main complication, the federal government chiefly offers loans, not grants. If it charged market interest rates, you could claim student loans cost taxpayers nothing. Yet despite loud complaints about usury, even unsubsidized student rates are well below market. Loan guarantees have no visible upfront cost, but you probably don't want to co-sign my personal loans for free. The Congressional Budget Office finds an average subsidy rate of 12%. Every dollar of student loan contains a hidden taxpayer gift of 12 cents. Many Americans imagine public education operates on a shoestring budget. Private education, in contrast, looks so pricey, it's implausible government does much to make it affordable. Both perceptions are wildly at odds with the facts. Government provides more than four-fifths of all education spending. Government support for education comfortably exceeds notoriously bloated defense spending. Even at the height of the war on terror, there was more government money for education than the military. Government spending on education is about 6% of the whole economy. Where does the money go? The U.S. government, like governments around the world, prioritizes K-12 over college. But higher education is more dependent on taxpayers than it looks, because so much private tuition has government fingerprints on it. In 2010-2011, government spent at least $565 billion on K-12, that's 87% of the total, and at least $317 billion on higher education, 67% of the total. The bake sale bumper sticker has misled a generation. The U.S. doesn't starve schools to feed its war machine. It serves both a resplendent banquet. Citizens are understandably nervous when they picture a government war on educational investment. Fortunately, no crusade against an external enemy is necessary because, as the cartoon Pogo famously quipped, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." Governments have a nearly foolproof remedy for educational waste. Spend less. Cut budgets for public education. Cut subsidies for private education. Once citizens embrace educational austerity, the central question isn't how, but where do we start? Cutting education. Why, where, how? When once asked at a public lecture in St. Louis how large the state should be, Coase answered, "If you see a man who weighs over 400 pounds and you ask me how much he should weigh, my answer would be less." John Nye, Ronald Coase, An Appreciation. When I argue education is largely wasteful signaling, most listeners yield. Popular resistance doesn't kick in until I add, let's waste less by cutting government spending on education. You might think conceding the wastefulness of education spending would automatically entail support for austerity, but it doesn't. The typical reaction is to confidently state education budgets should be redirected, not reduced. Such confidence is misplaced. The discovery of wasteful spending does not magically reveal constructive alternatives. Prudence dictates a two-step response. Step one, stop wasting the resources. Step two, save those resources until you discover a good way to spend them. Not wasting resources is simple and speedy. Don't just stand there, do it. Finding good ways to use resources is complex and slow. Don't just do it, think it through. Remember, you can apply saved resources anywhere. Time and money wasted on education could pave roads, cure cancer, cut taxes, subsidize childbearing, pay down government debt before our fiscal day of reckoning, or allow taxpayers to buy better homes, cars, meals, and vacations. Suppose I prove your toenail fungus cream doesn't work. I counsel stop wasting money on that worthless cream. Would you demur, not until we find a toenail fungus remedy that works? No way. Finding a real remedy could be more trouble than it's worth. It might take forever. Continuing to waste money on quackery until a cure comes into your possession is folly. Saying there must be a cure is childish and dogmatic. Maybe your toenails are a lost cause, and you should use the savings for a trip to Miami. The signaling model highlights two desirable forms of educational austerity. The first, cutting fat from the curriculum. The second, cutting subsidies for tuition. Let's explore both. Cutting fat from the curriculum. Anyone who scrutinizes modern schools with a mildly cynical eye witnesses piles of materials students are laughably unlikely to use in adulthood. The fat emerges in kindergarten. History, social studies, art, music, foreign language. By high school, as we've seen, students spend at least half their time on fat. In college, many majors are made of fat. Think history, communications, or interdisciplinary studies. About 40% of graduates earn degrees in comically or tragicomically useless subjects. Even the hardest majors burn ample time on high theory and breadth requirements. From a selfish point of view, as I've said many a time, the most useless coursework can pay off. Yet from a social point of view, these selfish rewards don't count. Purging the useless material is the socially responsible remedy. Return the hours we seize from the young at great taxpayer expense. When they're too little to release on their own recognizance, schools can still save a bundle by giving students more active time on the playground or more quiet time in the library. Once they no longer need babysitting, society can save even more by ending the school day the minute useful learning is done. A moderate form is to stop requiring useless coursework. Make history, social studies, art, music, and foreign language optional. The main problem with this moderation, pursuing material you're allowed to skip sends a favorable signal. Many students, urged on by their parents, will leap to outshine their peers, to defuse this wasteful arms race. We must do more than make armaments optional. We must constrain opportunities for combat. One constructive constraint is raising standards so high, most students quickly fall by the wayside. This is a bad idea for subjects students use post-graduation. Weak readers are more productive than full-blown illiterates. For subjects students forget post-graduation, however, unforgiving standards stealthily save time and money. Take music. When music is optional, lots of students waste years on it. Most of the waste vanishes, however, if intro music teachers cull the bottom 80% of the class. Students who repeatedly survive such weedings might even have a prayer of a future in music. The cleanest approach, naturally, is to discontinue classes that teach impractical material at taxpayer expense. There really is no need for K through 12 to teach history, social studies, art, music, or foreign languages. This is especially clear if you recall how much students forget. Despite years of schoolwork, American adults can't date the Civil War, name their congressman, draw, sing, or speak French. Why not redouble our pedagogical efforts instead? The standard reasons expected benefits of success are low and the cost is high. The same logic holds for college majors. Why should taxpayers fund the option to study fine arts at public expense? Instead, shut down the impractical departments at public colleges and make impractical majors at private colleges ineligible for government grants and loans. Deprived of impractical options, some students will switch to practical subjects. Won't plenty of others respond to narrower options by cutting their schooling short? Hopefully. If students refuse to stay in school unless they're allowed to waste public money, taxpayers should call their bluff. In practice, admittedly, FAT is a matter of degree. Most students will foreseeably never use advanced mathematics or science after graduation. For budding quants, though, these subjects are deeply practical. How should curriculum reformers respond? Sequentially, cut all obvious FAT post-haste. Next, briefly review the near-obvious FAT and cut whatever fails to vindicate itself. Then carefully examine the debatable FAT and cut with greater caution. Above all, we shouldn't dither on straightforward cases because ambiguous cases perplex us. As FAT disappears from the curriculum, students will inevitably find other ways to signal excellence to the labor market. Does this make curriculum reform self-defeating? No, because some forms of signaling are less socially wasteful than others. Cutting FAT leaves students with one well-lit path. Work harder in their real classes. Given American adults' woeful deficiencies in reading, writing, and math, that's progress. Cutting subsidies for tuition. Curriculum reform has one big drawback. Education officials have little incentive to cut FAT. As long as their funding holds steady, why should they confess that many subjects and majors are undeserving of taxpayer support? They've already opted for the status quo, so trusting them to pare down the very system they've built is naive. Voters could replace existing leaders with earnest Austerians, but the public's attention will eventually wander and the old regime will reemerge. These fears highlight a less gameable way to cut education. Shift the cost of education from taxpayers to students and their families. Raise tuition for public colleges, cut subsidies, turn grants into loans, charge borrowers market interest rates, impose at least some tuition for public high school. From a normal perspective, such proposals provoke the horrified reaction, attendance could fall. From a signaling perspective, the right response is, lower attendance is what we're going for. How does cost shifting raise education's social return? Supply and demand. Raising the price of school reduces attendance. The more attendance falls, the scarcer educated labor becomes, and the pricier it gets. Owing to signaling, the social benefit rises less than the selfish benefit, but social and selfish benefits still move in tandem. At some point, the education premium gets high enough to transform the marginal student into a good social investment. How much must the education premium rise to hit a respectable inflation-adjusted social return, say 4%? A thorny question because social returns have so many moving parts. When the education premium goes up, for example, students likely work harder to graduate, raising completion rates. Still, rough-and-ready numbers show the education premium must go way up. Suppose reducing the supply of educated workers affects only compensation, leaving all other outcomes the same. Further assume compensation for high school dropouts stays constant because the rising quality of dropouts offsets rising supply. Signaling severity governs the results. Given cautious signaling, the high school premium needs to rise only modestly. For poor students, a lower premium would serve because crime reduction overshadows their minimal acquisition of job skills. Any education past high school, however, requires unprecedented premiums, at least 100% for both the bachelor's and the master's. With reasonable signaling and excellent students, the high school premium must more than double, the college premium nearly triple, the master's premium more than quadruple. Justifying education for weaker students requires bigger run-ups still. How will we know when we've cut deeply enough? As long as my reasonable signaling assumption is worthy of its name, the quick answer is when high school grads earn twice as much as dropouts, BAs earn three times as much as high school grads, and MAs earn twice as much as BAs. How much will schooling have to fall before premiums reach such heights? A prominent but oversimplified model of the labor market implies America's high school and college completion rates are both about 20 percentage points too high. For changes of this enormity, though, don't take the models too literally. What's clear is that attendance must plummet. Can attendance radically fall? Sure, as long as government sternly cuts financial support. Researchers intently study the effect of subsidies on educational attainment. Since K through 12 is already free, they focus on college. When financial cost rises, how much do college attendance and completion fall? Answers land in a fairly narrow range. In modern dollars, cutting tuition or raising grants by $1,000 per student per year increases college graduation rates by 2 to 4 percentage points. Student loan subsidies are comparably effective. Unsubsidized student loans, in contrast, do little for enrollment or graduation. College finance specialists often announce they're searching for cheap ways to build the stock of college-educated labor. But we can repurpose their projections. If cutting tuition or raising grants by $1,000 per student per year increases college graduates as a share of the population by 2 to 4 percentage points, we can cut that rate by 20 percentage points by raising the annual cost of college by $5,000 to $10,000. Not the list price, the actual price. Assuming equal price sensitivity, the same goes for high school. To cut the ratio of high school graduates to population by 20 percentage points, annual tuition must rise by $5,000 to $10,000. Caveat, this is a very long-run solution. Raising tuition by $5,000 to $10,000 swiftly reduces the flow of new graduates, but the overstock of existing graduates will remain for generations. What about the effect of higher tuition on fertility? Anyone who fears overpopulation should be eager to shift the cost of raising children from taxpayers to parents. But even the staunchest natalist should recognize that subsidizing education is a poor substitute for subsidizing fertility itself. Education cuts could easily fund large child tax credits or outright baby bonuses. Yes, cutting education sounds outrageous to most Americans. They'll call it awful, crazy, mean, and foolish. Educational austerity is a secular heresy, a view no decent member of our society entertains. In the face of this profound resistance, I too feel tempted to sugarcoat. But I'd rather be clear than pleasing. Give heresy a chance. Once we grant the ubiquity of educational signaling, my main conclusions logically follow. Are draconian education cuts really a good idea, especially for a society as rich as our own? Calling them draconian begs the question. If we're not getting good value for our educational investments, we shouldn't call deep cuts draconian. We should call the status quo profligate. Rich societies can afford to waste trillions, but why settle for that? Rich societies face countless opportunities. The trillions we spend boring youths might cure cancer, buy driverless cars, or end world hunger. Collective complacency seems harmless, but it kills by omission. The hidden wonder of high tuition and student debt. High tuition and student debt naturally disturb education's defenders. Education is a great investment, so government should make it accessible for all. Strangely, though, education's critics often join the chorus against high tuition and student debt. Education is a bad investment, so government shouldn't expect people to fund it themselves. Take critic Peter Capelli. Using loans to pay for college is an idea with great appeal to economists because the people getting the financial benefit, the graduates who get good jobs, are the ones paying for it, presumably in the future when they have those well-paying jobs. If there is not a good payoff from the degree, then that argument falls apart. But what would happen if lawmakers made college free of charge? Everyone now deterred by tuition bills and student loan payments would rethink their decision, sharply boosting attendance. If, as critics contend, too many students already go to college, this is bad. Instead of joining the populist alliance against tuition and debt, critics of education should rise to their defense. Tuition does more than curb fruitless attendance. It improves the mix of majors. Practical majors already tend to be more selfishly and socially lucrative than impractical majors, but tuition rarely varies by field of study. As tuition inches up, then, impractical majors are the first to become losing ventures. Maybe would-be fine artists will rethink their major. Maybe they'll rethink college altogether. Either way, across-the-board price hikes point students in less wasteful directions. Student debt has the same upsides. Students who know they'll eventually pay for their education may still make foolish decisions. But at least they have an incentive to weigh their options and wonder how they'll repay their debts with an anthropology degree. Contrary to populists, student loan programs are one of the least dysfunctional parts of the status quo. Subsidized loans definitely encourage college attendance, but subsidies are too low to encourage it much. Compared to overall taxpayer support for education, loan programs are a rounding error. In part, no doubt, because student debt survives bankruptcy. Critics of student loans occasionally appeal to the Bennett hypothesis. Student loans pump up demand, perversely leading to higher tuition. What's the point of expanding access with loans if students respond by restricting access with tuition? From a signaling point of view, however, we should hope for perversity. The root problem with education is not too little access, but too much attendance. The more loans inflate tuition, the less they inflate credentials. Student loan programs could be improved. Government should charge higher interest rates or leave lending to the free market. But most reformers want to head in the opposite direction. Cut interest rates, replace loans with grants, forgive debts at taxpayer expense. Education's fans understandably favor such reforms. They want to make college cheaper so more kids go. It's baffling, though, when education's critics echo the fans' proposals. If too many kids go to college, publicizing bankruptcy law pushes enrollment in the right direction. Remember, kids, student debt is almost impossible to discharge. Relaxing bankruptcy law pushes enrollment in the wrong direction. Hey, kids, guess what? If you ever find yourself struggling to repay your student debts, you might not have to pay at all. Raising completion rates? Education's social return would spike if students finished every academic program they started. Researchers have found some promising ways to boost completion rates. Instead of cutting education spending, shouldn't we spend more to get students over the finish line? No. While completion rates can be nudged, they chiefly reflect past academic success. Better retention efforts will not make poor students perform like fair students like good students, or good students like excellent students. Even if they did, they would make education's social returns only a bit less awful, because returns are bad across the board. The only realistic way to sharply raise completion rates is to slash academic standards, a self-defeating path in human capital and signaling stories alike. When optimistic reformers protest, raising completion may seem elusive, but we've pinpointed special programs that work wonders. It's tempting to scoff, that's what they all say. But there's a deeper reply. Namely, completion rates have been low for decades. If wonder-working programs remain unadopted, the system is too dysfunctional to trust with extra money. The wise path begins with cuts. Get rid of all the programs that don't work wonders. Then, and only then, allocate some of the savings to the shiny outliers. This is common sense and a token of good faith to taxpayers whose money has been so squandered for so long. The strongest objection to making school more expensive is that it's self-defeating. Suppose economic hardship distracts students from their studies, depressing completion rates. Then cutting financial aid would make education's social return worse than it already is. Maybe the best way to get taxpayers a decent return is to spend whatever it takes to make school completely affordable so students can focus on their studies. Or not. Maybe making students bear the cost of school improves their academic motivation by giving them skin in the game. Consistent with these doubts, evidence on the link between financial aid and completion is mixed. According to a review of research up to 2005, most studies find grants modestly improve completion, but quite a few find no effect or the opposite effect. A 2013 review finds mixed evidence for no-strings grants, but positive effects of performance-based grants, like scholarships that make recipients maintain a B average. Even performance-based effects are moderate. Scholarships that cover most or all tuition boost college graduation rates by 3 or 4 percentage points. Performance-based funding is less wasteful than no-strings funding, but slightly higher completion rates aren't enough to tip the scales in education's favor. Not even close. Signaling and social justice. In a very few moments, I will put my signature on the Higher Education Act of 1965. It means that a high school senior anywhere in this great land of ours can apply to any college or any university in any of the 50 states and not be turned away because his family is poor. Lyndon Johnson, November 8, 1965. Most of us don't merely oppose shifting the cost of education from taxpayers to students. We recoil at the idea. When raising tuition curbs attendance, who is most likely to be curbed? The poor. Instead of fretting about education's social return, shouldn't we fix our gaze on social justice, our commitment as a society to our least fortunate members? These concerns would be well-founded if education were largely about teaching useful job skills. In such a world, raising tuition doesn't just make the workforce less skilled, it amplifies the inequality of skill. The poorer you are, the less you learn and the less you earn. Since education is mostly signaling, however, the social justice catechism is wrong. Yes, awarding a full scholarship to one poor youth makes that individual better off by helping send a fine signal to the labor market. Awarding full scholarships to all poor youths, however, changes what educational signals mean and leads more affluent competitors to pursue further education to keep their edge. The result, as we've seen, is credential inflation. As education rises, workers, including the poor, need more education to get the same job. Where's the social justice in that? Imagine the government subsidized wedding rings for the poor. Anyone ready for marriage can go to any jewelry store in the country knowing, whatever their income, they can buy a diamond ring. The snag, diamond rings are largely a signal of marital commitment. If diamonds were cheap as plastic, other gems would adorn our rings. They're valuable because they're costly. Once the government makes them affordable to all, then diamond rings signal little or nothing. Doesn't this level the playing field? Only for a heartbeat. Once the non-poor see diamond rings don't signal what they used to, they procure a snazzier ring to separate themselves from the pack. Thanks to government subsidies, every suitor can afford a wedding ring, but so what? Society is functionally as unequal as ever. Subsidies don't just hurt the poor by fueling credential inflation. They reshape hiring and promotion to the poor's detriment. Picture a society where half the population can't afford college. In this setting, reserving good jobs for college grads is bad business. There are plenty of qualified candidates who didn't go to college is not wishful thinking, but literal truth. Education still signals something, but lack of education is not the kiss of death. When asked, "Why didn't you go to college?" "I couldn't afford it" is a great excuse. Heavy subsidies take it off the table. Indeed, what excuses are left? I'm a bad test taker? I didn't feel like going to college? I figured I could learn better on the job? Once the good excuses are gone, employers have little reason to stay open-minded. More technically, subsidies raise the correlation between educational attainment and employability. By itself, this helps high-ability, low-income students, exactly as Lyndon Johnson suggests. Unfortunately, as the correlation between education and talent rises, education becomes more convincing to employers, and hence more lucrative. Rich rewards, in turn, spur students to amass even more education. If parental income were the sole determinant of educational success, education would signal little to employers and therefore entice little waste. I grant that subsidies seem to promote social justice. My best friend in my PhD program came from a poor rural family. If a top state school hadn't given him a full ride for his BA, he probably wouldn't have been sitting next to me at Princeton. Anyone who wanders a college campus will find equally visible success stories. To detect subsidies' downside for social justice, you must dwell on the opportunities the poor have lost because of credential inflation. When most Americans didn't finish high school, dropouts faced little stigma in the labor market. The stigma is now severe. When few Americans finished college, high school grads could plausibly work their way up the corporate ladder. No longer. The main difference isn't that the economy changed, but that education rose, so workers need higher credentials to compete. None of this philosophically undermines the quest for social justice. The point is that trying to speed up the academic treadmill is a misguided distraction from this quest. The planet is full of blatant social injustice. Hungry kids, hopeless adults, refugees from war and tyranny. The hundreds of billions our society fritters away on education every year could make a giant dent in these dire problems, even if your quest for social justice stops at the nation's borders. Why not fork over the hundreds of billions saved to America's underclass? Human capital purists may protest that this squanders our country's seed grain, but letting the poor eat the seeds is better than burning the seeds, signaling to each other. What I really think. Whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it is time to pause and reflect. Mark Twain. This is an audiobook about education policy, not political philosophy. My top policy recommendation, austerity, is less jarring for some political philosophies than others. Yet once you buy my central thesis, education has a low social return because it's mostly signaling, almost every political philosophy urges cuts. Liberals and conservatives may decry each other as evil incarnate, but both affirm that wasting taxpayer dollars is bad. Yet political philosophy is ultimately unavoidable because philosophy sets presumptions. Some philosophies have a presumption in favor of education, others in favor of the status quo. From these perspectives, the burden of proof rests on advocates of cuts. This burden is surmountable. Social return estimates amply justify spending 20% less on education given a presumption in favor of education or the status quo. But such presumptions still block radical reforms because there is minimal concrete experience with radical reforms. We can speculate that cutting spending by 80% would be a great boon, but when the burden of proof is against you, speculation can't surmount it. I favor radical reforms nonetheless. Philosophically, I am staunchly libertarian. While not absolutely opposed to taxpayer support for education, I have a strong moral presumption against taxpayer support for anything. Why? Because I have a strong moral presumption in favor of leaving others alone, and consider taxation to be a prime example of failing to leave others alone. Even if a tax has full democratic support, the burden of proof properly rests with the majority that wants to tax, not the minority that demurs. This burden, too, is surmountable. When taxation is the only way to avert clear-cut disaster, tax away. But taxing people to fund programs with modest or debatable social benefits strikes me as deeply wrong. I know libertarianism is out of step with modern political thought. If you're curious why anyone would hold my eccentric view, I outsource the job to philosopher Michael Heumer's The Problem of Political Authority. Still, when readers ask, what is the ideal education policy, responding it depends on your philosophy is a cop-out. Readers deserve full disclosure, even if it provides a convenient excuse to ignore the unphilosophical core of my case against education. All things considered, I favor full separation of school and state. Government should stop using tax dollars to fund education of any kind. Schools, primary, secondary, and tertiary alike, should be funded solely by fees and private charity. Such policies, lack of policies, are extreme even by libertarian standards. Most libertarians dream of a voucher system where schools are private but funding is public. Yet to my mind, vouchers and school choice more generally only marginally improve over the status quo. Since education is mostly signaling, the chief problem is not low quality, but high quantity. America's schools, like its sports stadiums, are white elephants. The main drawback of massive government backing isn't that these white elephants are poorly managed or uncompetitive, but that they're far too numerous and lavish. Government should